Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Julius Caesar has come to town to announce how the war efforts that he has led, how they've gone. And so he steps before a crowd of people to explain how it all went. And so according to others alive at the time, JC says, Veni, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. I like the Ghostbusters version better, but his was first. You can almost hear the crowd chanting in response to this. Caesar's coming to your town. To specifically declare his power, his dominion, his conquering of a neighboring people. This is a huge deal. The people decorated, they have special speakers, there's music, the games. Many people would go out and meet Caesar's procession about halfway out and then bring him back in. You can just imagine the soldiers, the sounds of horses' hooves and feet and the metal and the heavy wooden wheels. And your city, by the way, got to enjoy some extra security for those days while he was in town as a bonus. It's a super easy scene to make look cool in a film, but this is real life. And it's a sacred moment to citizens in ancient Rome. It's a don't miss it sort of moment. Well, the way that you would refer to this moment, had you been alive at the time, is super interesting for us to consider. Waiting for Caesar to show up to deliver this pronouncement in the Greek language, you would have referred to this event as a parousia or parousia. In Rome's Latin, it would be referred to as adventus. My Greek and my Latin are awful, so forgive me. But this is where we get our word advent. Advent means the appearance, the dawning, the arrival. So long before Jesus's birth or Christmas, or as my son once put it, the little box with all the little doors with presents for it in each day, this was how you celebrated the advent of the coming king. So once Caesar arrives, his message itself, that he's this declaration of how the war went, this is the Evangelion, which means good report. This is where we get our word evangelical. It means good news, good report. It's often translated gospel, but that's simply what it means, is good report. And again, this predates Christianity by quite a chunk of time. The citizens of the Roman Republic awaited the arrival of their Lord to bring them good news of great joy for all Roman citizens, for unto us a dictator is born. Enemies will be assimilated or eliminated. The borders are being forcibly expanded. The rich are going to get richer. The unyielding gravitational center of life called Rome is holding and will hold forever. Behold the Evangelion, the good news. Well, not everybody thought this was good news. Not at all. Because Julius Caesar had made it clear that he wanted all power consolidated and centered on him. He wanted to be dictator for life. He wanted absolute rule. An emperor over an empire, to be sort of the incarnation of Rome's eternal glory. Well, the Roman senators, they demanded enough of that. Julius, you need to step back, be a citizen again, you need to relax, let the Republic do its thing. I mean, Julius Caesar was a genius militarily, And he generally was respected, but Rome didn't need this. It didn't need a violent king with all power consolidated on him. But he wouldn't listen, and so he does become dictator for life, and he dismisses and embarrasses the senators along the way. So rather famously, Julius Caesar is assassinated by a conspiracy of these senators, and he is stabbed 23 times. In their minds, this is going to restore Rome to a republic. But it backfires. It becomes the reason the empire is actually born in many respects. Julius's adopted son, who went by Augustus, as well as several others besides him, they made a martyr out of Caesar and out of this moment. And not just a martyr, but a deity. They made him a god. And an entire campaign of propaganda began. And while there are countless sort of details that I highly recommend you at least skim Wikipedia about, it's pretty fascinating, this is the summary. They successfully added this assassinated Julius Caesar to the pantheon of gods to be celebrated and revered as divine. He was no mere mortal. He had been a god on earth whose body died while his divine spirit ascended into heaven. Now, as luck would have it, and this is confirmed by scientists and historians, a comet appeared in the sky right after his assassination, and it stayed there for a week, which is pretty convenient if you're trying to make a case that somebody is special in terms of like being a god, and then you get a week-long celestial event that you can use to back you up. That's pretty handy. So Augustus declares this comet is his father, Julius, ascending to his place in heaven. Julius Caesar, a god, now lives among the likes of Jupiter, which is Rome's Zeus, the supreme father of the gods, which, as it turns out, was a big ball of gas. They didn't know that yet. Later, the Roman poet Ovid, he made this claim seem like scripture. He wrote, "Then Jupiter the father spoke, 'Take up Caesar's spirit from his murdered corpse and change it into a star, so that the deified Julius may always look down from his high temple on our capital and forum.' He had barely finished when gentle Venus stood in the midst of the Senate, seen by no one, and took up the newly freed spirit of her Caesar from his body, and preventing it from vanishing into the air, carried it towards the glorious stars. As she carried it, she felt it glow and take fire, and loosed it from her breast. It climbed higher than the moon, and drawing behind it a fiery tail, shone as a star." Beautiful. But comet tails are made of ice, not fire. Coinage was probably a faster way than poetry for getting big ideas into the hands of the populace. And so you can see on this coin the eight-armed flaming comet that reads Divine Julius on the one side, because the story is already sacred history. And then, of course, you can see on the other side it says Caesar Augustus. This is Caesar's adopted son. His son Augustus becomes emperor. But obviously he's much more than this, because if dad is a god, then Augustus is the son of God. This becomes common knowledge. They call him this while he's alive. And again, long before there's a thing called Christianity or any Christian scriptures written, Augustus is being referred to in writings as Lord and Savior of the world, the Son of God, upon whose birthday the entire calendar is reset. The power and glory of Rome is rooted in the absolute, unyielding, centralized power of divine Caesar. And this is true and right. This is good news. This is peace. And before we look back and think, how could you be so stupid? How could you believe that your founding leader was divine? That's so ignorant. I'll remind you that in the United States Capitol building in Washington, D.C., there's a giant painting called The Apotheosis of George Washington, which depicts him as having ascended to heaven to take his place with the gods. That's really there. Now, at this point in history, most people believe the earth is round. Many of us were taught that people back then thought the earth was flat. Generally speaking, they didn't. Earth being a globe, that had already long been established by the days of Jesus. For some reason, tens of millions of people are starting to believe the earth is flat nowadays. That's a symptom probably of larger issues we'll have to leave alone for now. But in the first century and before the first century, it was pretty common knowledge that the earth was round. And there were really close estimates even on how big the globe of the earth actually was. However, the common understanding was that the Earth was the center of the known universe. This is called geocentrism, or Earth in the centerism. It would be almost a millennia and a half later before Copernicus dared to show that the sun was the center of our solar system. And amazingly, it was only about 100 years ago that we figured out that there were galaxies, let alone other ones, or that we were in one. So anyway, first century people knew that the Earth was a globe, but they generally thought that the globe was the center and that the sun and the moon and the planets and the stars and comets all moved in these circular pathways around us. And frankly, it's hard to blame them because it does very much appear to be the case that we're in the middle. Pythagoras, Aristarchus, they had sketched out a system with the sun in the middle, which was pretty smart, but it was just too apparent to everybody else. No, Earth is the center. So by Jesus's day, men such as Hipparchus, Aristotle, they had already established some really genius ways of describing how planets and stars moved with Earth at the center. And things in the heavens sort of moved in these layers, like fixed gears around the Earth, starting with the moon and then Mercury, then the sun and then the planets, the fixed stars behind them and so on. So with their models and their ideas pretty firmly rooted in everybody's minds, Ptolemy created a model that lasted for about 1,000 years before anybody finally corrected it. And the model that Ptolemy made is genius. Completely wrong, but genius. I mean, there's no high-powered telescopes or imaging software. These guys, I mean, they just invented maths. How about trigonometry? Maybe let's invent that to solve our problems. It was an amazing thing that they came up with. Ptolemy's model said, okay, so Earth is in the middle. Everything else moves in these really complex, perfect circles. But then he noticed several times a year, planets seemed to stop moving across the sky the way that they had been for months, and then they start heading in the opposite direction. Ptolemy didn't know that that's an illusion created by planets moving in ellipses around the sun while we're moving too. So he explained all this with a model using what he called epicycles. For him, and so for everybody after that, for a long, long time, everything seemed to be moving in perfect circles around the Earth. And then everything also moved in their own little independent epicycles, which is why they appeared to move backward at certain points. Now, this model was incredibly complex. It didn't offer any mechanical explanations as to why any of it was happening. It did lead to increasingly inaccurate, more and more inaccurate predictions. Didn't actually describe what was being observed as observational skill increased. But it was good. It was a good idea, good enough to base everything on for 1,000 years. And that's why, to this day, we use the term retrograde, as in right now, as of late November 2024, early December 2024, Mercury is in retrograde. It's about the third or fourth time, I think, this year that the planet Mercury has been seen suddenly moving in the opposite direction. Retrograde just means backward. I'm not here to put anyone's beliefs about astrology or horoscopes down, but we should admit to ourselves when we use these terms. We know things Ptolemy didn't know now. Earth is not at the center. We all know now that the sun being at the center explains this movement and these illusions. We all know now that the sun is at the center of the solar system, right? Well, not always, and not exactly, because strange as it may sound, right now at the center of our solar system, there's nothing there, including the sun. The sun is not the center of our solar system and won't be the center of our solar system again until about the year 2030. And hang with me here, because this, I know we're doing history and science, but there's some beautiful stuff in this for us, I think. While it's accurate to say that the sun is what everything in our solar system orbits, what's technically true is that the true center of our solar system is something called the barycenter. And I'm not a mathematician, but I can explain it like this. The Earth, the sun, has almost all the mass in our solar system. But Jupiter has a lot of that mass, and so do the planets and the moons. And so as Jupiter and the other planets move with respect to the mass of the sun and its gravity, the sun also draws toward the planets and everything else's gravity. And the result is a center of gravity that's sort of an average, found outside the center of the sun, outside the center of the planets, and it's around this decentered other space called the barycenter. It's around that that everything moves and turns. So please understand, I know what I'm describing is physics. This is hard science. And oftentimes people who do what I do for a living misrepresent things and to use for some illustration, and you end up kind of looking silly, turning all this stuff into magic. But here's the magic. In God's universe, nothing centers itself. Nothing is unaffected. Even the most powerful, the most significant, the most weighty and massive is moved by and with all else. Nothing seeking to remain self-centered can find a place in creation. Not even God. All reality is uncentered. All space and time function with humility. Everything in reality finds its center in relation to everything else. It's all like a cosmic width. It's only our illusions that are unyielding, unmoved. And you can build entire kingdoms and empires and movements and economies on these illusions. It can be quite lucrative for a time, but not for very long, because it's wrong. It's as wrong as fallen empires and Ptolemy's charts. So a science lesson, because it's awesome, and that's reason enough, frankly. Advent is the season of awe, and wow. But also, I am hoping that we would, especially during this Christmas season, and then everything that comes with it right now, I'm hoping we'd be willing to revisit the extremely familiar with a renewed openness, to see and hear and find it only seems familiar, but it's actually still unrealized, like a story we still haven't heard. Jesus is born into a world that already has an advent and good news and a supreme father and a son of God and a savior and a king and a kingdom and a new calendar and an astronomical event in the sky as proof of legitimacy. But then, very interestingly, Jesus is distinct. And they call him Emmanuel. God with us is the meaning of that name. Emmanuel, God with us. As if to say, not God up there, and not God going up there to live, not God we celebrate for being rightfully inducted into the distant pantheon, as top-ranking member, of course. My God could totally whoop your God, right? Not God is visiting to update us on a victory in Gaul, or God here but then leaving because of more important things. Not God is coming but only because his disappointment in our failures is what forced the visit. God with us, as if it's true now and is always true. God uncentered because of the weight of our existence. Even despite the difference in our mass, God with us. You could think of it this way, and it would be theologically and cosmologically airtight. Your existence moves divine mass toward you, not because of what you've done or not done, but because that's how it works, because you exist. The spirit of love, the creator and sustainer, uncentered by nature, drawn into the minutiae and the mundaneness of your moment-to-moment existence because, well, that's how everything works. That's how God made everything to work. You and I exist. Our life, our days, our cares and our joys, our hopes and our griefs, our interesting peculiarities and our unremarkable commonness, it all has gravity. It draws Emmanuel to us and us to Emmanuel. And there's nothing that can be done about this but to accept it. I mean, this is how things work. God with us. That's the good news. The kingdom is at hand. Because in God's universe, where else would it be? Everything moves with and toward everything else. So to consider this again, but like it's brand new, what universe do we think of ourselves as inhabiting? How are we allowing ourselves to participate in this way of Emmanuel? Don't hear guilt and shame. Don't use internal guilt and shame to make any of this a bunch of shoulds that leave you feeling like the good news is just another thing to feel badly about. This is a gift to reawaken to. How are you and I letting go of God as emperor, as cosmic dictator, and demanding all of us get into his orbit, and inviting us into his conquest, into his unyielding power, forcing all else into his orbit, or else? Or Emmanuel, the ever-present with, in whom we find life and growth and fulfillment and mutual off-centering. So at the same time, how are we living into decentering ourselves for others? If we're seeing God as this way because God is not Caesar, this is how everything is, then it's a question for ourselves. How are we decentering ourselves as well? Not erasing the self or letting others ruin our lives or take advantage of us out of some toxic confusion, you know, spiritual self-sacrificing garbage. How are we finding the fulfillment that comes from finding the gravitational center outside the center of me and outside the center of you, so a third thing beyond ourselves can be? So you already do this in a crisis. You have people that if the bottom falls out for them, you go right to them. You reach out, you call them, you drive them where they need to go. You watch the kids, you mow the grass, you buy lunch, you buy a drink, you lend your crock pot, whatever it is, you already do this. In fact, some of us, we don't feel like we're actually very good at love, not as good as we wish that we were. But man, you're a firefighter when it comes to responding to somebody in a hard moment. You just go right there without a thought, ready to do whatever somebody needs to do. See, we already do this. Most of us will slide right toward a crisis because it's got so much gravity. Sometimes to a fault, we jump into other people's pain so often or for too long without a break or without caring for ourselves. And then we find ourselves moving away from gravity. Many of us, we call this compassion fatigue. It's a real thing. It means that you've, for too long, for too many times, you're out of your own emotional barycenter. And you need to move back toward it to love you and accept love by others for you. I'll also add that this is why the thoughts and prayers thing has become so hollow and annoying for so many of us. Because if somebody who could but won't uncenter themselves because they're busy or they're politics, like it's bad PR or whatever it is, but they still want to offer that which doesn't require movement, it doesn't require them to move toward the gravity of another life. Thoughts and prayers, it doesn't register as something real at all. George L. Bell said, "You can pretend to care, but you can't pretend to show up." And I don't know if what George said is precisely true all the time, but it does get to something about how everything works, about the others' gravity drawing us with and toward them or not. So apart from how pain can be so clarifying of a moment for us to move toward and with, there's the regular every other moments and days of our life. And what's missing for a lot of us is a practice of showing up for others as though it's a discipline, like an exercise. For some of us, it comes easy. Just that's how we're wired. But many of us, we struggle with it because we hadn't considered making it a habit to decenter ourselves, like exercising, so that we can consciously suspend what's been automatic, our needs and interests being centered. The habit of, I just sort of naturally want things to be in my orbit. Again, there's no guilt or shame here. We are people of an empire ourselves. This is how we were raised. And frankly, it often feels like how else would I survive, get by, be happy, matter, and have value to other people? If I don't center my own interests, nobody else is going to do it. And we don't even know we're doing it anymore because we got good at disguising that's what we were doing. We even disguised it from ourselves. So it's recognizing how much of our lives are anxiety-based, where the gravitational center has to be held and defended, because without that, I will be lost. I will be undone. I'll be unseen. I'll be disappointed, or I will be found disappointing. And frankly, I mean, even the sun has to ever so often take a moment and return back to its actual gravitational center. That happens. And we have to do that. We have to go back and rest and recalibrate. The Gospels say Jesus did it here and there. This is essential for being a healthy person. The point is, we don't stay there. We don't make a personality out of it. We gently, consciously make sure it doesn't become a habit. It doesn't become our way. It's part of the overall rhythms that we live in, moved most generally by a sense of usness, people, all creation, rather than just me. Because otherwise, a center has to be defended. If we're going to live from a center, that has to be defended. And we cannot love and make peace while defending our own gravitational center against what feels like a threat. And so we ask ourselves this first Sunday of Advent, am I willing to consider how I might pattern parts of my life, my speech, my efforts, in ways that decenter, despite feeling like it leaves me disempowered, unseated, at risk somehow? Can I imagine myself taking on the way of Emmanuel in my regular walking around life? Can I think of myself as taking his hand away from my preferred center, even in a conversation with somebody, believing in that moment that I probably don't need to win anything right now or prove or correct or defend anything right now. And I don't have to always be understood. I don't need to take up more space or I'm going to dissolve into nothing. Even in conversations, can I walk away from this way of empire, this geocentric way of the meocentric model of reality, and instead ease into deferring to the width, to the toward, to the way of Emmanuel? This is hard for some of us, especially if we think we're already doing it as followers of Jesus. My son heard a server say to her table last week, "Merry Christmas, everyone." And I mean Merry Christmas, not Happy Holidays, because we got to put Christ back in Christmas. And he said, you know, everybody at the table is just kind of staring like, what? This is sort of the same thing, like people saying to love wins, saying no, God wins, as the winning love winning would be something other than God, who is love winning. It totally misunderstands the spirit of Christ needing to be centered. Like, it understands God as like always agitated, tense, angry, wrathful, a being that demands to be centered by, like, I have to be in the center of everyone's orbit, the unyielding middle. Or I get angry. I've got to be given recognition and compliance and credit all the time, or else. And so I won't pretend to know what Jesus is thinking. I just don't think he likes that. I don't think Jesus likes it when his people demand that he be the axis of all reality. His focus always seemed to be love and peace and living in the harmonies of creation. And then beyond that, just render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. So how can we, Emmanuel people, resist the temptation, build healthy habits of not working other people into the orbit of our ideas and our desires all the time, and then feeling frustrated because we can't figure it out? How can we slow ourselves down and watch for simple ways to sort of do an Emmanuel impression, from how I think about how this conversation is going, to how I do business with others or in competition with others, how I support people's interests, even if they're not my interests, how I put effort into sustainable living and buying and eating, despite not seeing any immediate results except for inconvenience, how I ask questions to be absolutely sure I understand someone rather than just assuming I get it. When I'm angry, how can I allow myself to sort of unfortress myself, to drift back toward that relational Barry center between us and say what I mean, but work even in my anger to hear you saying what you mean, to really take it on board? Or when I'm down, how can I find my Barry center outside myself when I just feel alone and down? Some of us who have depression, we know how persuasive it can be about telling us that we don't have the ability to move toward anybody. We just feel stuck, isolated at our own center. And this is a gross oversimplification, but sometimes it's saying to a person, I need you to help me dislodge from my own strong gravity a little. Or it's saying yes to somebody else who sees you that says, hey, let me invite you to a thing, and saying yes to it. let's go do a thing. Let's go do something. Let's move our bodies. Let's go get back into the flow, into the dance of all creation just a little, else we get stuck in our own lonely center. Whatever's happening, wherever we are, none of this is shame of the self. This is a gift of awakening to and re-understanding how we are made to actually function interdependently from the smallest particles to the sun to God. So as we close for with a time of communion, maybe a way to conceive of the mystery of the Trinity isn't so much the demand to believe a doctrinal statement about God's nature, but to acknowledge that it comes from this ancient intuition that God, ultimate reality, isn't fixed, isn't unyielding, but is even within God's self, relational and dynamic, uncentered movement, endless give and take. Maybe the Trinity is a divine physics for us to contemplate for its own sake, but also for us to be reminded of where we come from, what we're made of, how everything actually works. So more than ritual immersion in water, when we are baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, this isn't just the correct words so the water can be made to do more than get us wet. It's a declaration of our hope and our willingness to be immersed in this dynamic withness, to move from detached, isolated, centered living and thinking into God with us, us with God, us with us, that we want to begin living less transactionally and more Trinitarian, because that's a way of describing how everything actually is. As we eat the bread and drink the cup, my dear friends and siblings, may we dare to take in and take on Emmanuel. And in so doing, may we find and live not from our own fixed center, but from the very center of grace and understanding and curiosity and consideration and kindness with one another and with all creation. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.